Gosh, I've received more emails on questions for Dr. Michio Kaku than ever. But we're going to be back. We're going to answer some of those and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Michio Kaku and his number one best-selling book on the New York Times list, The Future of the Mind. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Michio, you got an email in from Aaron who wanted to know about your thoughts of the fractal universe and the difference of sizes of black holes and subatomic particles to universal particles.
Well, let's break down some of these ideas one at a time.
Okay.
First of all, black holes. We think they come in all sizes, from gigantic raging black holes at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. They can weigh millions to billions of times the mass of our sun. And then we have stellar black holes, that is, the black holes the size of a star. And some of these can even wander. We've seen wandering black holes. They're invisible, very hard to detect, but we've seen detected presence of wandering black holes, and one can sneak up on you and you would never know. And then we have microscopic black holes. This is theorized by Stephen Hawking, and that as black holes get older, they dissipate energy and get smaller, and so there's no reason why they can't even be subatomic in size. In fact, string theory even predicts that there should be subatomic black holes. And so we think, therefore, that black holes could be everywhere in the universe, in solar systems, in star systems, in galaxies, and that perhaps after the Big Bang, black holes determine the origin of the galaxies themselves. Perhaps there were black holes even before galaxies formed. And so we're beginning to think that perhaps black holes are very elemental in terms of our understanding of the entire universe.
This wondrous universe that we're in right now, it is just absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it?
That's right. We're entering the golden age, where we're finding out about all these things. Get any textbook just 20, 30 years ago, and most textbooks were quite boring. They said that we have all the science fiction about black holes, but they probably don't exist. Now they're just chock full of mysteries and chock full of new discoveries being made in cosmology. It's one of the most active fields of physics, for God's sake.
And as a physicist, are you glad you're living in this time frame now as opposed to during Einstein's earlier era?
Well, I think it would have been great to live around 1925. That's when quantum mechanics was born, and Nobel Prizes were just flying off the shelf for young physicists. Now I think we're entering a new era, a golden era where we have experimental data, to back up some of these far-fetched ideas. We have satellites. We have supercomputers. They didn't exist 20 years ago, powerful enough to detect these things. Like, for example, the Higgs boson would not have been able to be discovered using technology of old.
Right.
So we're entering the golden age.
You looked at dreams in your work, The Future of the Mind.
That's right.
Tell me about this.
Well, it turns out that if you put a human in a MRI machine, and the MRI machine can scan blood flow of the brain, and then it can reconstruct an image of what you are thinking about. If you think about the Mona Lisa, the computer will construct a reasonable facsimile of the Mona Lisa, and then when you fall asleep, the machine keeps on going and will actually print out the first pictures of a dream. This was once considered preposterous, but hey, we can do it now with MRI scans. And we can even look at old wives' tales like lucid dreaming. Lucid dreaming is when you are awake, when you are dreaming. And that was once considered impossible. How can you possibly be conscious when you're unconscious? But it turns out it's true. In Germany at the Max Planck Institute, they've actually tested lucid dreamers, and sure enough, they are conscious while they are unconscious. They can actually change the direction of a dream. And in fact, in my book, I even talk about the movie Inception. Is it possible to enter someone else's dream or alter someone else's dream? And I think it is possible. In fact, I give you a blueprint of a machine that, in principle, might duplicate some of the feats of Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie Inception when he enters other people's dreams.
That will be huge. I think that's possible, too.
And it's all possible because of physics. Physics allows us to calculate blood flow of the brain, which in turn mimics electrical flow within the brain, which in turn allows us to reconstruct images that are circulating inside the brain.
Let's go to
By the way, I think that That one of these days, when we have the connectome and we have all the mathematics of the brain on a disk, we'll send it into outer space on a laser beam. And so this could be the fastest way to explore the galaxy at the speed of light. This is what science fiction writers have dreamed of, exploring the universe at the speed of light on a light beam. This is now possible because the politicians are dumping billions of dollars into the Connectome project. Once we have this disk with all our memories and emotions on it, we can send it to the moon. And in 1 second, you'd be on the moon. No booster rockets, no worrying about weightlessness, no budget overruns to worry about. 1 second, you're on the moon. You're on Mars in 20 minutes. And you'd be on the nearest star in 4 years. And in fact, maybe the aliens in outer space have already constructed this.
That's true.
Maybe there's already an intragalactic highway system by which connectomes, that is souls, of aliens are being shot across the galaxy at the speed of light. And we are too primitive to know it. We're too primitive to know that in our own backyard, there could be a highway. A highway by which people's connectomes, with all their memories and emotions on it, are zipping along on laser beams.
Remote viewers would say, we can do that right now.
Yeah, well, imagine doing it for the galaxy.
Yeah.
At different stations, when you download the connectome from a laser beam from a distant star, what you do is you download it into an avatar, into a surrogate. And so when you wake up in the body of a surrogate. And then if you launched off to the next star, you wind up in the body of another surrogate. And the surrogate, of course, doesn't have to breathe oxygen. It could adjust to any gravitational field. You become a Superman on different planets. And this is all within the laws of physics. I'll give you a blueprint of how this might actually be built.
Stephen Bassett, who is trying to get government disclosure of the extraterrestrial presence with you, has brought your name up as the person in the event we're visited publicly. You should be the one to be able to do this, that you should be the spokesperson for the planet. That was quite an honor when he said that on this program a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh. Well, it would be an honor, but I think the honor should be shared. I mean, the responsibilities, of course, are enormous. When two civilizations make first contact, there's all sorts of problems with miscommunications and misreading of intentions. And so I think it's a great honor, of course, but I think there should be a committee of wise men and wise women who have a historical, scientific, broad viewpoint to assess this information, because many times civilizations misread each other's intentions, and we get into all sorts of problems that way.
Let's go to the phones now. We will go to Jason in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on with Michi Ukaku. Go ahead, Jason.
Yes, I'd like to ask about harnessing comets or asteroids, sort of like sending up some type of rocket thruster that would land on one and anchor itself and slowly force it into our orbit, and then we could use it to, you know, get elements or minerals or study it at a safer distance. I want to know if that's possible and what are the benefits or risks of doing so. And I'll take my answer off
here. Sure thing. Interesting question. Could we literally pull an asteroid or a comet, Michio?
Well, in principle, yes. This is called mining the heavens. About 2 years ago, billionaires from Microsoft and Google had a press conference where they said that this could be the next bonanza in outer space. And, of course, it's always good to spend other people's money rather than your own tax dollars to explore the solar system.
Yeah.
And if Google billionaires are willing to put up the money to do this, more power to them. The proposal mentioned was absolutely correct. Instead of going out to the asteroid belt, which is very expensive, why not lasso? Why not lasso an asteroid, put retro rockets on it to deflect its orbit so that it comes into an orbit around the planet Earth? Then at leisure, we could visit the asteroid, we could begin mining operations, and make money on it. And, of course, that was the name of the game for these billionaires that made this proposal. Their first step, however, was more modest. Their first step was to build telescopes, gigantic space telescopes, not to take pictures of stars, but to take pictures of asteroids, to see what's out there, to plot their trajectories, to see which asteroid is worth mining for the future. Now, let's be fair about this. This is a technology that's not going to come to fruition soon.
Right.
We need booster rockets. We probably need astronauts. We need an old infrastructure. But their goal is to have it self-sustaining so that taxpayers' dollars aren't simply wasted chasing after some ghost, but real tangible dollars and cents, specifically platinum-based metals. Certain platinum-based metals are very rare and very expensive, and we think they could be mined on these asteroids. And so it is a proposal being bandied around. The Obama administration has mentioned a landing on an asteroid, which could be the first step toward eventually lassoing an asteroid. For example, in 2029, the asteroid Apophis comes whizzing around the planet Earth, and there was some talk that when the asteroid Apophis comes around, it's about 1,000 feet across, why not lasso it? Why not put rockets on it and deflect its orbit so that it orbits the Earth?
What about the downside? Could they pull this in too close so that it would crash into the planet?
Yeah, there's a downside, too. If Apophis ever were to hit the Earth, it would be not just a city buster. It would be a nation buster.
Yeah.
It would take out Germany or take out France. So we have to be very careful.
Yes. Could be a planet killer.
To be a planet killer, you need something about 5 miles across. Apophis is about the size of the Rose Bowl. And so it would be enough to take out Germany, but not enough to take out the planet Earth.
Let's go to Jack in San Diego now, west of the Rockies. Hey, Jack, go ahead.
Well, I've got two questions. One is a religious question, and one is a scientific question. So let's start with the religious one. Based on your knowledge, do you believe that the universe was created by intelligent design or by random chance?
Well, I think we have to separate two things. First of all, when Einstein was asked about the universe, God, meaning, he says we have to be clear that there really are two kinds of God. The first God is the personal God, the God that smites the Philistines, the God that you pray to for that bicycle at Christmas time. That's the personal God. Einstein could not believe that the universe was created just to satisfy our Christmas dreams and to smite our enemies. He believed in the God of Spinoza, that is, the God of order, harmony, simplicity, elegance. That the world is gorgeous, but it could have been random. The universe could have been ugly, messy, without complex chemistry, without beautiful objects. And yet here we are, conscious beings coming out of the so-called chaos. And so he believed that there was an order, a cosmic order. He called it the Old One. And he thought that that was the God of Spinoza, that is, laws that allow for a very simple but very compelling creation of a gorgeous universe. That was not an accident for him.
And do you think it's a combination of both yourself?
Well, again, the personal God, it depends on, you know, which person you talk to and which religion and so on and so forth. So I stay away from that, just like Einstein thought that, why would God spend so much time worrying about our personal affairs when he has a universe to take care of? And however, the God of Spinoza, that is the God of elegance and beauty and simplicity, is very compelling. On a sheet of paper, on one sheet of paper, you can put all the known laws of physics, that is the quantum theory, the theory of relativity, all of it can be put on one sheet of paper. The goal of string theory is to put all of it into a single equation 1 inch long. That's the goal of string theory. But so far, we can put all the known laws of physics on a sheet of paper. And it didn't have to be that way. The universe could have been chaotic. It could have been messy. And then the question is, who wrote that sheet of paper?
Who did it? That's right. Okay, Jack, let's go with your next question.
Yeah, my second question is deals more with science. Now, I always felt that the universe was infinite. But if you suggest that there's parallel universes, other universes, my question to you is then, how do you know when you're at the end of our universe? What would it look like?
Well, at one point, science fiction writers thought that a rocket ship would hit a brick wall, and the brick wall says the end of the universe. But then you want to know what's on the other side of the brick wall, right? Well, if our universe is a bubble, then perhaps the farthest object of the universe is the back of your head. So that if you were to fire a rocket in the forward direction, eventually it would come back and hit you in the back. Now, we don't know for sure whether the universe is infinite or whether it's finite. The latest information is still inconclusive. And so I'm sorry that I cannot give you a definitive point of view. However, if the universe is a soap bubble, which is the picture that most physicists use, it means that probably our universe is finite in four dimensions, but infinite in three dimensions. That is, if I fire an arrow, the arrow never hits a brick wall. It just keeps going around and around and around and around. So in three dimensions, it's infinite. But in four dimensions, it's a bubble, which is finite. Just like the Earth, Columbus would have said that in two dimensions, the Earth seems to be infinite because you can sail with the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria around the Earth over and over and over again and never hit the end. So Columbus would have said the universe is infinite in two dimensions, but finite in three, because the Earth is nothing but a globe, said Columbus. And so Einstein comes along and elevates it one dimension and says that perhaps our three-dimensional universe is infinite. That is, there's no wall at the end of our universe. But in four dimensions, it's finite.
If it's finite, do you push yourself up against something?
No, you're like a bug on a gigantic balloon.
On the outside?
On the surface of the balloon, the bug says the universe seems to be flat and the universe seems to be infinite because the bug can go round and around and around the balloon and never hit the end. But we, sitting in hyperspace, we sitting in the third dimension, realize that it's just a balloon. And now give it one more dimension. So our universe is three-dimensional in the sense that we don't see a brick wall out there. But in four dimensions, it could be finite. It could be a hypersphere.
Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, there's our friend. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, Dr. Kako. I'm an amateur astronomer and an atheist. I mention that because the caller just before me talked about a personal God, and you did too. Well, inflation, if inflation is proved out even more with more data from the Planck satellite that'll come out, as you know, this October to December this year with its final all-sky data, if it proves out inflation for the whole universe, like BICEP 2 did in South America, in the South Pole, BICEP 2 did, wouldn't it show, in other words, that if the multiverse is true, there are infinite universes in the past, as well as infinite universes in the future, as well as infinite universes, parallel universes now, meaning that the personal God of the Bible, when it says, in the beginning God, there was no real beginning and there's no real end, because the universe is extended, extend infinitely before the Big Bang into the past, as well as infinitely into the future. So the personal God of the Bible, the Judeo-Christian Bible, is obviously wrong.
Well, when I was a child, my parents, I realized, were Buddhists, but they put me in a Christian Sunday school program.
That's right.
And so I've had to coexist with two ideas in my mind simultaneously. The Christian God said there was a beginning, let there be light, and there was Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. But in Buddhism, there is no beginning, no end. There's only timeless nirvana. Now with the multiverse idea, we can meld these two diametrically opposed ideas into a beautiful single theory. And that is, in our universe, there was a beginning. In our universe, there was an instant when we set off the Big Bang. But this Big Bang exists in a much larger arena of nirvana, that is, 11-dimensional hyperspace. And so the multiverse idea says that the genesis of the Bible, in some sense, can describe our universe, but there are other universes floating in timeless nirvana.
I love that. Michio, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michio Kaku with us, The Future of the Mind. That book is available because it's already number one on the New York Times bestseller list. That's exciting, Michio, isn't it?
Yes, I've never had a book that hit a grand slam, number one on Amazon, number one on Barnes & Noble, and number one on the New York Times list, which to me shows that there's a real hunger out there. people really want to know what's inside their, what sits on their shoulders, because ever since we began to be conscious, humans have wondered about what the mind and consciousness is all about. And now, because of physics, we're able to actually plot blood flows and energy flows in the living brain. We can actually see thoughts ricocheting around the brain like a ping pong ball. And old wives' tales can now be either verified or dismissed.
Let's go to Ray in Niles, Ohio. Ray, you are on the air with us. Go ahead.
Good evening.
Hi.
I have a question about the multiverse, the number of multiverses. It seems to me that there are two possibilities. Either there is an infinite number of multiverses or a finite number. Now, if there's a finite number, there has to be some physical law or some rule that maximizes that number. What would that be? I can't imagine what it could be. On the other hand, if you have an infinite number of multiverses, then you get this outrageous scenario where there would be, say, a universe exactly identical to this one in every respect, except in that universe, George Norrie has one less hair on his head, and that's the only difference. Then there's another universe exactly identical to that, where Michio Kaku has a little piece of lint on his sleeve that's not there now. Every trivial thing you could possibly imagine would have its own universe. That's certainly logically possible, but it seems patently outrageous. Furthermore, if heaven and hell are logically consistent universes, they too would exist. And I want to know what Michio has to say about that, and I'll take my answer off the air, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. Now, Michio, that's a lot there. Go ahead.
Yeah, in fact, there's even a science fiction story about inventors who are able to access all these parallel universes, and they were able to steal inventions from these parallel universes to become millionaires.
I love it.
However, in this story, the inventor eventually commits suicide. And so a reporter wants to know, why do these millionaire inventors who steal these inventions from parallel universes commit suicide? And then he realizes that when these inventors peer into these parallel universes, in some parallel universes, the serial murderer gets away. The bad guy gets away scot-free. And he realizes that there's no causality with respect to crime. In some universes, criminals are never prosecuted. And so there's no justice in the world. And so some of these inventors commit suicide because they realize there is no God. There's no lightning bolt that's going to strike down the evil. Evil can flourish. Now, my particular point of view is the most probable universe is the bad guy gets arrested. He does go to jail. In some universes, yeah, they go free. But in most universes, the probability is very likely that the bad guy goes to jail. So there is some justice after all.
In Leonardo da Vinci's era, is it possible he was a time traveler, went to the future, and came back with all these ideas?
Well, that's the first thing that pops into your mind when you read his notebooks, because you realize he was talking about inventions that wouldn't come to fruition for centuries. You realize he had a blueprint for a robot. I didn't know that till I read a book about da Vinci, a robot knight. And of course, it was based on a watch. And with all the gears inside. Mm-hmm. But he, in his sketchbooks, he was talking about airplanes, talking about parachutes.
Helicopters, submarines.
Calculators. He even designed a complete calculator that would actually work. And so these inventions wouldn't really come to fruition for a few more hundred years. And so that's why people do realize, hey, gee, I mean, this guy is out of his time. I mean, he doesn't belong in that time frame.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Brennan's with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Brennan.
Hello, George. Michio, I wanted to thank you very much. On March 17, 2011, you and I got to speak on the same show, and I got to ask you about the potential of string theory helping me to place a telephone call back to 2009. A friend of mine was in an ultralight plane crash, and what I'm wanting to find out from you today is do you have an update to the ability of me to call back to the 26th of February and tell my friend to stay off the ultralight that eventually crashed in Torrance, California. I'm trying to figure out how can I correct that timeline. Now, earlier this evening, you really alluded that we can't go back in time. And if we have these divergent rivers, my question is will one of those rivers be able to loop back and correct that time?
And I remember that call back in March of 2011.
Right. Well, here's how it works. If you could go backwards in time, you would create a time travel paradox unless the river of time splits, which, of course, is what the quantum theory says, that time itself is a quantum object, and so things split all the time. In that timeline, you have saved your friend. In that timeline, you have prevented Abraham Lincoln or John Kennedy from being assassinated. You've changed the course of world history for that universe. However, for your own universe, sorry about that, for your own universe, you know, things progress the way that you remember them. And so you can change other universes' past, but you cannot change your own universe's past. That's how you change the past. You change somebody else's past, but not your own.
All right, great. I hope that works out for you, Brent. It's got to be frustrating when you need to go back into time at you to correct something, and you just can't do it yet.
Right. And that's why, by the way, Stephen Hawking originally was against the idea of time travel, because he thought that there were these paradoxes, and anything that went backwards in time could replicate itself and create an infinite number of copies of itself. And so Hawking said time travel is not possible. But you see, that's a non-quantum picture. In a quantum picture, the river of time itself forks into two rivers, and you don't have an infinite buildup of copies of yourself. And so that's why Hawking's criticism, I think, has to be amended once you introduce the quantum theory. So once you quantize time, then there are no paradoxes in time travel stories.
We've got Antoinette in Sunset Beach, California, first-time caller. Good morning, Antoinette. Go ahead.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
You know, I hadn't thought of this in a while, but the theory about being able to dream other people's dreams, you can do it. I've done it. They say with love, there's many things you can do and conquer. And I was so in love with my husband when I was married to him. I would be able to sleep by him as I did and dream his dreams. I finally mentioned one time. We're divorced now, but I did scare the holy heck out of him. But you really can enter someone's dreams.
I think you can do that if you're tuned up. To be able to do it. Go ahead, Mitchell.
And George, in my book, I actually give you a way in which it may be possible to enter someone else's dream. If we have this MRI scan that allows you to photograph a dream, and then you are allowed to watch that dream from a distance, you can see the progression of that dream. And then if you put contact lenses, which have the internet on them, you could put motion pictures into the contact lens. And so as they're sleepwalking, you could put visual images into their dream, which would then show up on the TV screen. And so you could actually then begin to alter second by second the progress of somebody else's dream as it happens.
Exciting. Nicholas in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on with Dr. Michio Kaku. Nicholas, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's a great honor to be speaking to you, both of you.
Oh, thank you.
I was just wondering, NASA in 2016 has plans to undergo the Cold Atom Laboratory, which they're building to study matter at extraordinary conditions close to absolute zero. And I was wondering that in relation to Einstein's time travel theory about traveling close to the speed of light and going into the future. Are there any theories that if you stayed absolutely still or got close to absolute zero, that you would also travel through time? For instance, if the space station, while it was in orbit, was able to calculate the flow at which the universe was traveling and position itself so that it was entirely still and motionless in space and reached like a true absolute zero, if you think that the expansion of space-time might pass whatever material has been frozen and have anything to do with time travel.
In other words, instead of racing near the speed of light, where we do know that time slows down, we measure that with the GPS satellites, you want to go the opposite direction of slowing something down to near absolute zero to see what would happen. Well,
yes.
It turns out that you cannot reach absolute zero. Absolute zero is a state of no energy, no vibration at all, and that violates the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle simply says that things are uncertain, even the number zero. The number zero is also uncertain, so you can never attain zero energy. And therefore, absolute zero cannot be attained. And we see this in the laboratory. We can go down to about a billionth of a degree above absolute zero. That is an incredibly cold temperature. But we cannot hit 0 degrees in the laboratory. And so it's a nice idea of yours. But unfortunately, because of the quantum theory, you cannot really hit absolute zero. And that's the third law of thermodynamics.
What do you think, Michio, could be the next huge breakthrough in physics that would be just one of those wow factors, well, as you call the aha factor?
Well, very soon we might be able to snag dark matter in a laboratory. Dark matter makes up 23% of the universe, while we make up 4% of the universe. And dark matter is invisible. And the Hubble Space Telescope has given us maps of dark matter surrounding galaxies, but we need to find some on the Earth. We need to find some in our laboratory, and we could. Right now, we have many teams on the Earth right now with gigantic vats of liquid. When a proton hits a piece of dark matter, it causes a blip of light, and we photograph that light. And so we have thousands of cameras looking for that flash of light caused by the collision of a proton with dark matter. So far, we find nothing. But that could be a game changer, because it means that there's a new form of matter that holds the galaxy together. If it wasn't for dark matter, by the way, we would be flown into outer space. We wouldn't be here without dark matter. Dark matter keeps the Milky Way stable, keeps it warm, so that we can exist as life forms in the Milky Way galaxy. Without dark matter, there is no Milky Way galaxy.
And Michio, so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so this could happen any day. Any day, some university could announce that they've photographed that flash of light.
To me, matter is something you can physically touch. Can you do that with dark matter?
No, because it's invisible and your hand would go right through it.
It would go
if
right
If I held dark matter in your hand, it would literally dissolve through your fingers, go right through the floor, go all the way to China, and then turn around in China and come all the way back to New York, and it would oscillate between New York and China.
Amazing. Almost like another dimension, that kind of a feel, isn't it?
Yeah, and we think dark matter is nothing but the next octave of the string. The next set of vibrations of the string beyond matter, we think, is dark matter. So dark matter could verify string theory once we find it.
Let's go to Gerard, truck driving in Los Angeles. Hello, Gerard. Go ahead.
Mitchell, you are my hero. You're a rock star.
thank you.
I read your hyperspace book when I was a freshman in high school, and I never got the book back because I gave it to my math teacher who gave it to my physics teacher, and it disappeared. Anyways, I was going to ask if in the next couple of years, what would be the classes I would want to take if I went back to school to be a physicist?
Well, if you went back to school, I think there are two kinds of courses you can take. One is the survey courses, where you talk about the gee whiz factor. You learn about cosmology, about Venus and Pluto and the asteroids and comets. And I think those kinds of courses would keep your interest alive. Because once you hit a real physics course, they hit you with calculus. And so if you're a little bit weak in the math, you may want to shy away from hitting the heavy courses immediately, okay? I mean, after all, Isaac Newton created calculus so that he could solve simple physical problems like falling bodies and the moon's orbit around the planet Earth. And so I wouldn't go right into physics immediately if you're weak in the math. And so to really understand the math, you really have to have calculus. It's trying to understand French civilization without understanding how to conjugate French verbs. Sooner or later, you have to conjugate verbs if you want to speak the language of France. So you can read survey courses about French history, but to really get into the guts of French thought, you really have to learn the language. And the same thing with physics. The language of nature is math. And so I would advise you to take some survey courses before you really hit the books and learn physics.
Michio, what was that point that got you into physics? There was that moment, I'm sure, when you were a young
man.
Yeah,
there was that moment. I was 8 years old. A scientist had just died, and everyone was talking about the fact that he couldn't finish his greatest work. The evening newspaper had a picture of his desk with the unfinished manuscript of his greatest work. And I was mesmerized by this story. I said, what? The greatest scientist of our time couldn't finish something? What was wrong with him? what kind of problem was this? Later, I found out the man's name was Albert Einstein, and the theory that he couldn't finish was the theory of everything. So I said to myself, that's for me. That's what I want to do. I want to help to complete the theory of everything that this great scientist could not complete. And today we have a candidate for it, you know, string theory. We think that could be the theory that eluded Einstein for 30 years.
That's exciting. Good for you. Did it come easy for you or was it difficult?
Well, unfortunately, it is all mathematics. In fact, we want to reduce all this mathematics to an equation no more than 1 inch long that would allow us to, quote, read the mind of God. That's the goal, an equation 1 inch long that would allow us to read the mind of God.
Brian is in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Brian, let's get you in here. Go ahead.
Hey. I guess I have a couple quick questions. When you look at consciousness, wouldn't you, you know, necessarily have all of your memories? And that's the definition of death, when you don't have your memories anymore. It's that important.
Well,
your comments.
Let's I know you had another question, but let's answer this first, time permitting. Memory. Is memory death, Michio, if you lose it?
Well, it turns out that it is possible to lose all your memories. The hippocampus is an organ at the very center of the brain. And if you have an injury to the hippocampus, a stroke or something, or even Alzheimer's, you lose the ability to form memories. And so you literally relive the moment over and over and over again because you keep forgetting as soon as you learn something. And there's a guy, unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, named Mr. Malayason, who had surgery on his hippocampus and was damaged. And he relived that same day over and and over again for decades. It was such an unusual story that they made several Hollywood movies around it, 51st Dates with Drew Barrymore and Groundhog Day
with Bill Murray.
Both Hollywood movies are inspired by the sad story of Mr. Malayason, who had brain damage and only lived in the present. He had no memories of what just transpired.
Well, they did a good job both in those both Hollywood works.
Mm-hmm, right. And in my book, by the way, I even give you a ranking of consciousness. I even give you a definition of consciousness. And because I'm a physicist, a numerical ranking of levels of consciousness. So animals, I think, are conscious. They have a different kind of consciousness. We would have the highest level of consciousness because we see the future. We plan, strategize, we see tomorrow. Animals do not see tomorrow. And that separates animal consciousness from human consciousness.
That's a big deal. Michio, thanks. Good luck with this work, The Future of the Mind. Let's see how long it stays number one on the New York Times bestseller list. We'll be back in a moment with Steve Quayle in World Events.